Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. It's like coffee with an analyst, or it could be whiskey with an analyst reading a spreadsheet, linking crime events, identifying a series, and getting the latest scoop on association news and training. So please don't beat that analyst and join us as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 8 years of law enforcement analysis experience, with 20 years of law enforcement experience overall. She started out as a financial investigator and has recently became a certified law enforcement analyst with FDLE. She's currently the president of the Northern Florida chapter of ILEA. Please welcome Amanda Wiggins. Amanda, how are we doing?
Hey, Jason. Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Very good. So we're in Florida, and it's a little chilly here in Northern Florida.
Yeah, these cold temperatures are a little much for this Florida girl.
I was talking with somebody from Boston today, and she didn't want to hear it.
It's cold down here.
I was like, it's all about what your expectations are, right?
This is true.
I do not expect it to be 23 degrees in Tallahassee. That's my problem. That's my expectations.
I would agree with you.
All right. So how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Probably say I was first introduced to it back when I started as a financial investigator with the Department of Revenue, using financial records and actually starting to do analysis, but not really realizing that I was analyzing anything at the time. I thought I was investigating. But what I've come to learn is that investigating and analysis go hand in hand. So I would say that that's where it really started for me.
Yeah. So I actually want to go back a little bit farther, because you recently just got your bachelor's degree. So your career has taken off without a degree. So you've worked your way up to that point of being a financial investigator. So take us back a couple years prior to that.
Sure.
I actually started my career in the accounting field, in the private sector. And I worked my way through every avenue of the accounting world, including accounts payable, receivables, payroll, creating and reviewing financial statements, all aspects of accounting. During that time, my husband worked for the state, and we were actively moving around the state pursuing career opportunities for him. So I knew that it would be beneficial for me to get on with the state to transfer more freely in regards to employment. So I got on with the Department of Revenue as a revenue specialist. In that position, I helped govern the taxes and collect those taxes for the state of Florida. At the Department of Revenue, my position progressions at the Department of Revenue moved into the financial investigations unit. So I found that my accounting background just served me well at revenue and still will serve me well here at the Gaming Control Commission, as I'm going to be dealing with a lot of financial investigations in the future as well.
Yeah. It's interesting. You mentioned before the link between investigation and analysis. And I would imagine the same holds true in terms of the data, right? The data that you're working with in revenue prior to becoming a financial investigator.
Yes, absolutely. Data has a story to tell. And it's just as if you're reading a new book, right? You have a general idea of what the book is about, but you don't know what all the details until you read it. And analysis does that for you when you're reviewing data.
So as you become a financial investigator, then even though the data might be the same and data tells the story, it's still obviously different in the fact that you're part of the team that's the aggressor there, trying to figure out if somebody broke the law. And obviously them not being so forthright and probably trying to avoid any kind of punishment there. So from that angle, then, just to talk about becoming the investigator, I would imagine it is a different mindset than what you had done previously.
For sure. So I think that too, looking at the financial records from the individuals that we were investigating, my background in accounting served me well because I know what should be on the left side of the balance sheet versus the right side. Mm. And knowing what expenses are legitimate and what is not, and what pretty much what looks right and what looks wrong. And those things would jump out at me, and it helps you uncover my, I think my experience helped me uncover during investigations where money could have been hidden or placed that it normally wouldn't be. I believe that even as an investigator, you're trying to prove somebody did something wrong, but sometimes you really have to keep the mindset of, did they do anything wrong? It's not necessarily going at, there might be an accusation that they did something wrong, but did they really? And the data and the data and the evidence and the financial records, they're going to tell you whether or not that they did something wrong or not. So that's how we rely on that data to help us tell that story.
Yeah. It's funny. We were just talking in the beginning about expectations on temperature, and then you're getting into what you would expect to see from a ledger. And that experience served you well. Because to me, I have not worked many financial through my career. And so to me, when I think of going through financial records and just the amount of data, and to me, it would almost be like just going in blind, because I wouldn't have that expectation, right? I would be probably questioning everything, because I wouldn't know what is normal and what's not normal.
For sure. And I think too, what was unique about the position at the Department of Revenue is a lot of these were individuals who were tax business owners who are taxpayers remitting that money to the state. And those cases got forwarded to us investigations because they were not remitting those taxes. So then we would have to look into, yep, this is true. They're not filing those taxes. And then it would develop into an investigation where we would have to get their business records, their bank records, and look at to show that the money did come in. It just was not remitted. So it was interesting. It was one of my most favorite jobs.
Yeah. Now, can you talk about any cases during this time? Is there a particular, do you have a favorite case that you worked on?
I mean, most of my cases are closed from Department of Revenue. I think probably the most memorable, and it wasn't necessarily from the investigation standpoint. I actually had a person show up to court to remit his money that he was being charged of by stealing state funds to the tune of $10,000 in cash. That was pretty memorable, having to go into judge chambers and count out $10,000 in cash. So I would have to say that one probably is the one that sticks out the most.
Did you do a lot of testifying during your time here?
I did not. A lot of times they would not necessarily settle, but they would want to do a restitution plan, which is another part of the investigations at Department of Revenue. There was a program called the Tax Collection Diversion Program, which deferred prosecution in some of the cases that we had. So a lot of that, I did mediation. I did more mediation than anything else. The only time that I really had to testify was actually during that one case that went to court. Well, there was more than one case that went to court, but in that one case where the business owner showed up with a briefcase of cash, I was having to stand there with the assistant state attorney to help explain to the judge what that crime that was committed, because a lot of people know about murders and all of the drugs and all of those big cases, and they kind of have an expectation of understanding that. But when it comes to tax crime, a lot of people look at you like, I don't understand the words that are coming out of your mouth. So having just to stand there and explain what those charges meant and what got us to that point.
So you were an investigator for almost 11 years, and then you went on to be a fraud analyst supervisor with the Florida Highway Safety. So what went into that decision to go to Highway Safety?
My husband had accepted a position in a different area of the state, and Department of Revenue at that time didn't have any investigative positions in that area. So I started having to seek other job opportunities in the area that we were moving to. And it was during that instance that I was afforded the opportunity to become the fraud analyst supervisor at the Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles, which was to include standing up the fraud analysis unit.
Oh, so they didn't have one before you got there?
No, it was a brand new unit that was going to help look at analyzing driver's license and motor vehicle fraud and reviewing data to help identify trends and conditions of what was happening through those activities. But standing up that unit and helping develop it, that's really when I probably got my, I started a true love for data analysis more than anything else, and looking at the data and throwing it into a software system that would visualize the data for us. And it would, what you knew and what the data was telling you and how it would visualize it for you.
So as you look back during this time and setting this up, what were some challenges? What do you think of when you think about this time of setting up this unit?
A lot of what I'm feeling too right now with the Florida Gaming Control Commission, it's when you walk into a unit or an agency and you're help building the foundation of something, it's very interesting, but extremely challenging, but more than anything at the end of the day, it's the most rewarding. My bureau chief at the time had a vision of what he wanted the fraud analysis unit to be, what he wanted it to produce. And I got the role to help bring his vision to life. And so it was interesting because it was something that I walked into that had never been done before at that agency. And I helped develop that. So it was something that was something I look back on and I'm pretty proud of.
What you mentioned software. So is that software that was there prior to you getting there, or is that something that you identified and helped bring into the unit?
I didn't identify it. The software was Tableau, and mm-hmm. It's a visual analytic tool. It was something the agency had brought in for agency-wide to use, and we started utilizing it. We were one of the first units to use it outside of the data scientists that are there in Performance Management Bureau, and it really helped visualize where the issues were, and we were able to mitigate the fraud from that aspect of identifying and then trying to mitigate what we could do to prevent it.
So then you got the software, you got the data, right? What about the personnel? Like, how did you go about filling the positions for the unit?
Thankfully for me, when they hired me as the supervisor, they had already chosen two analysts for the position, and they came from in-house with Florida Highway Safety, one with a vast knowledge of motor vehicles, and another one with vast experience with driver's license. I had other support staff that we used as OPS workers. They were mostly administrative, but it really helped for them to understand the method behind the madness of having to look at the vast amounts of data that we were looking at and processing the amount of requests that we were getting. So that's
how did you get your cases?
We got our cases through the driver's license fraud unit and the mm-hmm. motor vehicle fraud unit. Also worked hand in hand with the quality assurance program, and they would find stuff in their audits. Driver's license fraud and motor vehicle fraud would have cases that they would work that would need a furtherance of that investigation or a furtherance of that complaint that we would have to look into, and we worked it that way.
So in 2019, then you joined the Florida Highway Patrol as a supervisor intelligence officer. So how did that differ? Just, I guess, compare and contrast the two jobs.
Stepping into the Florida Highway Patrol, which a lot of people don't realize is a division of the Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles. So I didn't change any agencies. I just kind of changed divisions. Mm. In that is where I was at the fraud, on the fraud analytic unit, was non-law enforcement. Whereas going over to the Florida Highway Patrol is law enforcement. That's the law enforcement arm of the highway safety. So it really shifted to, I was overseeing a team of intelligence analysts who directly supported all the troopers statewide. So we had two teams of analysts, and one of those teams was the team that I had the opportunity to lead.
Okay. And so that seems like a pretty hefty task, right? The entire state as patrol officers are doing their job around the clock, that you all are being asked to support them.
Yes, most of our support system went for the investigators, but we did help troopers as well and command staff. We were in the Bureau of Investigations and Intelligence. Mm-hmm. So my team did most of the intelligence side, and the other team did a lot of the investigation side. But as you can well aware, you have one big room of analysts. We did have some in the field, but we have a big room of analysts. A lot of times a lot of our tasks would overlay one another. So we would do anything from report requested from another agency all the way down to a photo lineup or a next of kin. There was cell phone investigations that they would do. We would create intelligence bulletins. You're probably familiar with like a BOLO, what a BOLO would have to go out, or if a certain crime or trend that we were seeing, we would create a bulletin and send that out to look to other agencies. If you've had this in your area, please reach out to this investigator. We would help develop those products as well.
All right. So this is really the first time you're outside of the fraud arena, right?
Yes and no, because a lot of the troopers, if those driver's license or motor vehicle investigations from the administrative side of the house, let's say back in the fraud analytic unit, if any of that turned criminal in nature, those cases got forwarded to Florida Highway Patrol to pursue them criminally. So we would still see driver's license and motor vehicle fraud in some of the investigative operations that we supported.
But now, are you getting an opportunity to go beyond financial records and getting into investigations of like violent crime?
Yes. But as their supervisory intelligence officer, I was a supervisor of the team. Mm-hmm. So this was actually really, I kind of stepped back from being in the weeds of the investigations, and we would support the investigators in their efforts.
So what were some of the issues that you were trying to resolve and help lift up the analysts that you were supervising?
I feel that as a supervisor, any issues that kind of interrupt the flow of what they need, what tools they need, what resources they need to be able to do their jobs effectively and efficiently. Mm-hmm. I believe that it was my job to bridge that gap between what resources that would make our life easier as an analyst, and to be able to produce it more quickly, not only for a productivity standpoint of view, but ultimately as an officer safety, to make sure that we got those results to the investigator as quickly as possible.
Now, do you feel that there was too much data, or do you feel that there were major gaps in the data sets that you wish your analysts could have, but maybe that was a struggle getting access to that type of data? Where I'm going with this is sometimes there's, even when I was an analyst, there was data sets that I was like, oh, I really wish I had that data set. Or that when it came to the most of the data that it was within the department, that was pretty easy to come by and I could get access to that. But as a barrier, there were certain data sets that were either really difficult to get a hold of or just not readily available. So for automation and to get into our databases. So trying to get into the idea of what some of the struggles were and some of the things that you were able to resolve.
When it comes to actually getting access to the data, highway safety and motor vehicle side of the house for data warehouse, the business warehouse where all the data is stored, they were very helpful with us getting, if we needed to know all white Yukons that are registered in Monroe County, we would put in a request. And being that it was a law enforcement request, a lot of times those requests took precedence over other requests because they knew that it was time sensitive. So we were really fortunate to have good relationships with the stats group on the highway safety side of the house. So we were able to get industry and agency related data fairly quickly for any type of request and or support to the investigators that were requesting information.
As you mentioned, that your current position now is with the Florida Gaming Control Commission. So you've just been doing that almost a year now, but it is your first analyst gig, if you will. By title, it's the Senior Crime Intelligence Analyst 2 position. So how has that been for you, the trajectory and your path thus far, getting into a lot of fraud, expanding out to being a leader, being a manager, doing intelligence, supporting investigations and law enforcement side. And now you go over to the Gaming Control Commission, which is, just, again, it's just a little bit different.
It is a little bit different. To give a little bit of background, because I know a lot of people are not familiar with the agency because it is a new agency, the Florida Gaming Control Commission was actually set up back in summer of 2022 by Governor DeSantis to preserve and protect the integrity of gaming activities in the state.
It was a brand new agency, and it's actually has a law enforcement arm to it. Is the first state law enforcement agency, if you will, that has been stood up in the state of Florida in 30 years. So stepping over here, it's a completely different realm, but with a lot of the still of the same common threads, if you will. It is my first analyst position. It's the position that they had at the time, but they looked to me and asked me, could I come stand up their intelligence unit? And I said yes, and it's because, and I'll tell you, Jason, the reason why I did it, one of the reasons why I did it, is mainly because this is foundation building of a new agency. It's legacy building, and that's something that you don't get the opportunity every day to do. So I stepped out of a management role into an analyst role to help them set this unit up, and it's been every bit of challenging, but again, rewarding at the same time, taking me back to my days in the fraud analytic unit. It's new, but I've been here before.
Yeah. So what did you learn and implement this go around after going through the process of setting up the fraud analyst unit with Florida Highway Safety?
Well, in the short 8 months, well, actually going on 9 months now that I've been here, it's been a lot of getting the accesses to the databases and getting everything lined up with the CEJA side through FDLE, making sure that we are following 28 CFR to make sure that we're following all of our federal guidelines. And I'll tell you, that's something that you kind of take for granted, is walking into a job where you're just coming into a position that somebody vacated, and then you get trained how to do that job. Nobody trains you how to just build a unit and having accesses to all of these databases. So it's been a lot the last 9 months. And like you said, I just went through the Analyst Academy. Mm-hmm. So part of these last 9 months, 6 months of that has been the Academy as well. So I've had that on top of, you know, setting up the Intel unit. And it's been interesting. So I think to answer your question really is, what's different from standing up the unit at the fraud analysis unit as to standing up the Intel unit at Florida Gaming Control Commission? There was a vision of my bureau chief and what he already had been seeing and doing, but wanted to create a unit to govern that activity. Now, we've been able to really build the unit to help support our law enforcement in making sure that these investigations are seamless and making sure that the mission that has been put before us is achieved. And it just goes back down to, okay, I need links or I need all of these other accesses to all these databases. Well, all of that usually comes memo of understanding, which I'm sure mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And that's just, it's a lot of time that is stretched mm-hmm. out to get these things. So, and we're still in the process. We're still mm-hmm. in the process of still gaining it 9 months later. So it's definitely been interesting.
Yeah. You mentioned the difference between setting up a brand new unit or replacing somebody. It's not for everybody, right? I often talk to people. I work from home. I've been working from home since 2018. And I say working from home isn't for everybody. And I don't know from my vantage point if I would like this idea of everything has to be established. And it's a lot of administration. A lot. You talked about the MOUs. You talked about just getting everything started to the point where it's going to be years before maybe you feel that the unit is up and running. That's a whole different skill set as opposed to coming in and tactically managing a unit to help support any investigations, let alone something with gaming.
Absolutely. I would completely agree with you there. I believe that setting up this unit, it is a lot, but we are still also still working active investigations. We're mm-hmm. still on law enforcement officers as I speak throughout the, and we're going to have three separate regions in the state, a north, a central, and a south region staffed. But at the same time, we have lots of complaints coming in through online complaints, people calling the office with complaints, and we're looking into those actively. So we use what resources we have. We link up with our law enforcement partners that are already developed that we can partner with and work together. And yeah, I think we're well on our way to be our own standalone unit, to be able to be self-sufficient, if you will. But right now we are really relying on our law enforcement partners throughout the state.
So I realize you have maybe a lot of active investigations going on today, but I wanted to give the audience a sense of what types of crimes that you're investigating or the complaints that are coming into your office.
Mostly what we're seeing is the public who see these gaming facilities that are illegal in the state of Florida, and they don't want them in their neighborhoods because they breed other crimes, drugs, human trafficking, prostitution, and they don't want that for their communities. We're also receiving complaints for the individuals that are going into these facilities and putting money in these slot machines and the machine telling them that they've hit a jackpot, and then that business owner refusing to pay them their prize. So they're not real happy with those business owners either. So we're getting complaints from a little bit all over the place.
How prevalent is it? How many we talking about here in just that jurisdiction that you just described?
We don't even have a number yet. That's how new it is, but with the amount of information and intelligence that we have received, there's thousands.
Yeah. It seems like that was on TV a lot, where not the slot machines per se, but you would have maybe this backroom card game going on, and something like that could be set up pretty quickly. You just need some tables and some cards in an area. It wouldn't take very much to set these things up.
No, you would be surprised. And what's interesting in how they set up is they try to set up covertly, really. And they're in these strip centers. So you would think, okay, it's right in front, but they don't really put any signage up. So they don't have a lot of money invested in it other than the machines.
Yeah. But it's also, as I think about that, so they're looking for office space, right? In a time when office buildings and office space might be vacant because more people are working from home, like I mentioned before, you have these types of businesses. Yeah, I need some office space. I need some office space that I can have a front, and I can have plenty of space in the back to do this gaming that I want to do.
Yeah, and you still have property owners that are wanting to lease their space, and whether they're understanding what they're doing when they get in there or not, now they're in the midst of also looking at being held accountable, because now you're allowing this illegal operation to happen in your property. So it's a lot of, I think we have a hurdle to jump over here for education as well, and awareness for the community, business owners, landowners. There's a lot to understand about it and know the complexities of it, but also realizing that it's illegal in the state of Florida.
Hi, this is Mitri Lewis, and I want to say, make friends with your other analysts. Don't just stay in your own little world, in your own little bubble, but hey, meet the other analysts who work in your jurisdiction, who work in your county, who work in the jurisdictions around you. Have lunch. Go play cards together. Do something together to get to know each other. It will benefit you in the long run.
Hi, this is Sheila Dorn. Do you want to build your credibility with field personnel, with police officers on the street? Get a candy dish. Put it on your desk and fill it with good candy. That's your opportunity to talk with people and engage. You can send out a million emails. People might know your name, but they don't really know you until you talk to them face to face. And that candy dish is an opportunity to talk with people and really get to know them.
So then you got certified with FDLE through the academy. So I've talked to a couple other analysts that have gone through this training, but I think you're the one that's the freshest off the boat type of thing, that you just graduated. So it's all of it is very fresh in your mind. So I wanted to get your perspective on how it benefited you. What do you think about? What stuck out? What you liked the most? Just to paint that picture.
I would say overall, the academy was a really great experience. And I think it, even somebody who's, yeah, yes, I've never been an analyst until this, you know, current position as in title. But even like I said before, financial and being a financial investigator, investigations and you know, analysis kind of going hand in hand. Anybody from a lot of experience or just coming out of college and getting their first job with an agency and then getting sponsored to go to the Analyst Academy, I think any skill set it would be great for. They had everything from the like personality tests for true colors and public speaking, critical thinking, how to write a bulletin, statistical and financial analysis, which I probably would have to say that's probably my favorite part. Probably given my history, that was probably a given. You also have to write an analytical report as part of it. You have to do a group project with other analysts and present to the FDLE board. That can be a little bit intimidating for some folks, but it was a really great experience. We had about 3.5 days to work up a scenario, and it was very interactive with a person that we were designated to gather information from and was given information real time to help develop our case. And then we had to put that in a presentation and present all in the same week. So sounds very intimidating. I'm not going to say it wasn't stressful, but it was probably, looking back, another one of my favorite parts as well. So, and I think that a lot of what they did at the academy, like true colors, learning people's personalities, knowing, you know, that helps you learn how people operate and being able to identify those differences and embracing the differences and helping people work together, because we're not all of our personalities are not the same in one office. And you have to know that different people work different ways. And as basic as that sounds and not really truly analytic, it really does help you in being able to be successful with working with others. Because as an analyst, you may be the only one in your agency, but you also may be on a team of analysts that helps you, and that would help you understand others. Public speaking, having to be able to give a briefing to your command staff, critical thinking with helping you think outside of the box, not going down a rabbit hole, but being able to think, how is this going to benefit my case or my work? Bulletins, not everybody does bulletins, but that was a great exercise that we did. I used Excel a lot, did some statistical and financial analysis, like I said before, learning, especially for people, I'm a little bit of an Excel nerd, but even for this Excel nerd, those formulas were something to behold with some of the stuff that they showed us. So it was challenging, even for me at times. So, and then the common thread, of course, through all of that was the analytical report. And they're kind of trying to foster all of these areas throughout the academy as the common thread to help you build your analytical report, because they're going to expect you to speak publicly for your group project. They're wanting you to think critically, to develop your report using statistical and financial analysis and develop products that support your analytical report. All of that is the common thread throughout the academy.
Now remind me again, to qualify to be part of this academy, you have to be an analyst in Florida, correct?
No, you do not.
Oh, you don't?
No, we actually, in our academy, we had a sworn officer actually from North Carolina.
Oh, and she, okay.
Yes, she drove down every month for 6 months. She's sworn, but she's also the analyst for her agency. Mm-hmm. So it was, and I will say that about the academy, is it's nationally recognized.
Sure.
And I think that, and I'm not sure if I can quote this right or not, but I want to say it was Arizona that Kyle mentioned. Kyle Christensen, who is the coordinator for the academy, helped get their analyst academy up and running for their state. So it's something that's definitely recognized throughout the U.S.
Okay. I guess I didn't realize that it was outside of the state of Florida. And certainly the majority of them are within Florida. And I do think that that's so powerful in terms of going through this and with a cohort, and you instantly have network connections all over the state from somebody that through going through this program that you can call pretty much almost all parts of Florida that you now have a connection to.
Absolutely. Matter of fact, speaking of that the analyst from the sworn analyst that's from North Carolina, just talked to her this week. and we were talking about an Excel formula of all things that we used in the academy. And she's just like, do you remember how we used that? And how did we get this to work? And we just jumped on a Teams meeting real quick and we worked it out. And yeah, when we have those, and the rest of the folks that were in my academy class were from Florida, but even you have people that was in that academy that are moving on to other states. I've just got notification today that one of the folks that was in the academy is moving up north to take a position with a federal agency. Now I have not only, I have a federal connection now that if I need something on the cyber side, that I've got that guy that I can call. So another benefit from the Analyst Academy for sure.
Yeah. And one of the soapboxes, and I have many on this show, is training in general. I think you go to these training conferences, or you might go to some training that's available to you, and it's 100% lecture based. So you go there, you sit down, somebody presents from beginning to end. There's not much hands-on, mostly just awareness. There's just bringing it to your attention. And it's a struggle to, when it's 100% lecture based at some of these training and conferences, is like, then like, what am I bringing home? What do I have to show for it to my agency that I went to this week-long conference and it was like, it was a lot of awareness. It was a lot of people. Not that what they're doing is not important, but it might, there wasn't a lot that might have been tangible that I could bring home and show and share with others. But certainly with this, it's so hands-on, and you're doing group projects and you're teaching and doing skills. It's not just this lecture based the whole entire time. Not there is some of that obviously, but it's not 100% lecture based. And so you can go back to your agency with actual skills that you learn through this program.
For sure. I completely agree. And it's something too that it not only benefits me, of course, yes, now I have that certification, I have that credential, but it also benefits the agencies because it is taking back that knowledge to those agencies. And something that I even shared at graduation was we started the academy to better ourselves and our agencies, but now it's our turn to be that difference, to be the difference maker, whatever you do. And whether it is coming away from a lecture base is bringing back something that you can implement. But I do understand what you're saying too, is the value in hands-on exercises. That was, I'm a visual learner myself. Mm-hmm. So having somebody present it to me and show me, okay, this is how we do this, this is how this operates, and then giving me the opportunity to put my hands on the keyboard and start doing it myself, it kind of makes it, closes that gap, and it helps you grasp onto the concept a little bit better.
And you just finished the last class. Do you know what they're up to in terms of the number of certified analysts? I recently had Alex Goulday on, and he was thinking that they should be pretty close to 1,000.
I would probably agree with that number. We were class 36, and I believe we graduated 30 in our class. Mm-hmm. So 30 times 36, that's over 1,000.
That's impressive. Very impressive. So, all right. Very good. Let's move on then. Let's talk a little bit about ILEA. And you are the chapter president for the Northern Florida chapter. What all does the Northern Florida chapter cover?
The Northern Florida chapter covers everything from the Panhandle all the way to the Eastern Coast where Jacksonville's located, and then all the way down to about Orlando, maybe a little bit further south of Orlando, but Orlando's about the cutoff. Mm-hmm. And then that's where the South picks up. I know that there have been discussions about creating a central chapter. So I think that's kind of like keep your eyes peeled and your ears open for that news. I think that's going to be announced shortly. Mm-hmm. And that will help those analysts in those areas that might be stuck right there in the middle of the state. And it's hard to travel to Miami if you're in the Southern group, or if you're in Orlando and it's hard for you to travel for the quarterly meetings in Tallahassee, having a more centralized chapter, I think is going to help those folks as well.
Yeah. And is there an online option?
I don't know that there's an online option. I know that when we had our executive board meeting for the North Florida chapter, that's something, that's a topic I actually brought up, is to consider going to a hybrid approach and maybe doing a online meetings. We did that during COVID. Right. A lot of what we did went to online when we were during COVID. And I think we just have some technical challenges there with being able to project with a camera onto the screen or with a big room, because if you do hybrid, you'll have some people in person and some people not. So we've been working through those challenges as well to offer that option.
Yeah, it does get challenging. And for those that aren't maybe necessarily familiar with the geography of Florida, you get into 4+ hours pretty quick traveling from one side of the state to the other. So it can be a lot to ask folks to show up for a meeting when you have to travel 4+ hours to get there.
Yeah, especially for like an hour and a half to 2 hour meeting. Traveling plus your meeting time is your whole 8 hour day. So
yeah. So I guess besides the logistics of that quarterly meeting, what are some other things that you're working on and hoping to implement in the future?
We're hoping to, the North Florida chapter does not currently have a website or a social media presence. So that is something that we're currently working on. Our interim secretary has been very vigilant in working on that. So we're going to hopefully have that published soon. We have had discussions about bringing FIAT, which is the foundational training for intelligence analysts that's done through ILEA from the international level, and bringing it to Tallahassee, which is something that's open to analyst, and it's a sought after training as well.
That is a good training. I used to teach that way back when, so I'm sure it's changed a wee bit since I did it probably over a decade ago now, but that's a really good training, and it has a similar approach to what you described with the certification, in that you break up into teams and you get a case assigned to you, and you have to break it down and present your findings. So it's similar in that regard of what you described.
Yes, and I personally haven't participated in the FIOC course yet, but I know that there are several members. Our past presidents, Kelly Kimsey, is an instructor. I want to say Alex is an instructor through FIOC as well, but I may be wrong in saying that. But we have a lot of people here in Tallahassee that have taken that class and have talked about that it's a great class to have.
Let's talk about the hiring process now for analysts. And this is a topic that's I've been on asking different guests their perspective. And a lot of folks out there listening to the show, maybe they're newer analysts looking to move up. Maybe they're looking to get into the profession. Maybe they're an experienced analyst who's mentoring one of these folks that are younger analysts or somebody looking to get into the field. And so from time to time, we talk about different topics. And so I like to talk to folks like yourself there that's gone through the hiring process on the side of the manager for analysts, and just get your perspective on things that you hold valuable as you're going through the hiring process. Maybe some stories about what somebody did really well, and then if you have some, then some kind of don't be that analyst type scenarios there that you've also seen. So I guess in general, what do you look for, or is there maybe a certain skill set or something that you hold valuable as you're interviewing somebody and trying to figure out whether they're going to be the best fit for your unit?
Well, that's a great question. I think that in my experience of being on the hiring board for other analysts, it's kind of hard to dictate like any kind of cookie cutter education or discipline to cover all of the industry, because there's so many facets through an investigation to even have the niche. You have cyber, you have phone analysis, you have all of these different financial investigations. You have all of those that are kind of little different niches, if you will. But I think overall, looking aside of that and just speaking in general, you're always wanting to make sure that as a manager that you're picking the right person, their personality for the culture of the office. But independently of that, I'm really looking for someone who's got really great communication skills, both oral and written. I know that at the previous agencies that I've been at, we do work samples, and a lot of that is written, being able to have good written skills, because again, you may have to do a bulletin, you may have to send out an executive summary on something. So you want to make sure that these people can write well, but in the interview, that's your opportunity to present how your oral communication is. Are you good at public speaking? Are you good at briefing? Because let's face it, an interview is public speaking, because you're speaking in front of people, generally, most times you don't even know, you've never even met. So it can be intimidating, because you are trying to put your best foot forward. You're wanting to represent yourself correctly, but your nerves may take the best of you. And I think that going in there and knowing that yourself the best out of everybody else in that room, and just take comfort in that and take confidence in that, and that will help you through that interview. I believe that also is true with presenting during briefings. Once you get that job and you're an analyst, you may have to, your command staff may walk in the room and say, hey, that shooting investigation that we had 2 days ago, what's the most up-to-date word that we have on it? And you may have to stand up and just go off the cuff. And knowing that you can do that in an interview, you can also do that on that spur of the moment as well. So I think you're always prepared, but I think you You also are your best advocate of your person, and you're also the best advocate of your work product.
Yeah, I do find it fascinating. I get your point about when you're in that realm of being at that table in a 3-panel interview, and in that realm that is showing off communication skills. But at the same time, I find it interesting because that may be the only time in the history of your employment there at the police department that you will be in that scenario. There's not a lot of times where you're being interviewed by like a 3-person panel. Normally it is a presentation type thing that you're dealing with. That's more of the natural day-to-day duties of an analyst, like what you're talking about here, where someone comes in and says, give me a briefing on this, or what do we know about this? And in that regard, when you're presenting in that fashion, it's a little bit different than answering these interview questions that you're trying to maybe sound memorable or not say something that trying to figure out what they're really trying to ask you. And that's a little bit of a different skill set, right? You may never be in that scenario ever again, but that's a big part of how you get hired.
Yeah, I mean, I see that too. I think that though, in an interview, you have to think on your feet because you're not given the questions beforehand. And when you're going into a briefing, you're not given those questions beforehand either. And they may be rapid fire questions. Mm-hmm. You may have to give the briefing to the investigator, but you also may have to give the briefing to your director or your colonel, your undersheriff, whoever it is that's going to walk in the room, and that's kind of impromptu or not scheduled. You have to be able to think on your feet. And I think that I would probably encourage people to remain confident in yourself in an interview. Confidence that is humbling, humble confidence, if you will, not going in there overzealous and being overconfident, but humble confidence is very becoming.
Yeah, I think you say what you know, and don't be afraid to say that you don't know.
Oh, but, absolutely.
Right. So I think you definitely don't want to go in there and BS and overpromise and underdeliver. But at the same time, if you know for sure that that's the answer, that you're okay to be firm in that.
And, oh, absolutely.
And you're going to run into scenarios where, hey, I don't know that, but I'll find out and get back to you. That's how I would handle that if that becomes an interview question, which I've gotten from time to time. Like, what do you do when you don't know the answer has been an interview question for me.
Exactly. Right? What you don't know is an opportunity for growth, period. I mean, and being willing to be that person who I'm willing to learn that. I can't say that I can speak from experience based off of that question. Mm-hmm. However, if given the opportunity, I would love to grow with your agency in that realm. That's that's just showing that you have drive, you have the passion for the job, and wanting to learn more. Come in with what and be willing to learn more.
I think, and if that's not who you are, if that's one of your items to work on, right, that you need to improve upon. I mean, this is where getting involved with something like Toastmasters, or getting, the more you do it, the better you will be. And so that's, I think, one of those things. Again, we go back, I sound like a broken record, but you can go to a lot of training, analyst training, and never be taught any tips on presenting or improve your speaking skills at all. I mean, sometimes you get tips and tricks on, you see other people, how they present. But doing will be better for you in the long run than just sitting and observing.
I agree. I definitely agree. You have to get involved. And whether it be your local chapter, the local chapter for ILEA, getting involved as a volunteer and helping out and embracing, getting up and speaking in front of somebody, get up and make announcements at your church, something that baby steps. Toastmasters is a great outlet to do that in as well. You get comfortable with the group that you're with, and then you're among friends. And then it's like I say with anything with public speaking, it's really just a conversation you're having. It's one-sided a lot when you're up giving a speech because you're the one doing all of the talking. But really, it's just you expressing what and what you want others to know. So I think that there are definitely some opportunities there to branch out with your public speaking or any type of communication skill that you can use that for.
All right, let's go on to some advice for our listeners. Usually I leave it pretty open, but for you, I am curious what advice you would give analysts who may be assigned a financial investigation for the first time. Maybe some of those tips and specifically in the realm of financial investigation.
Well, financial investigator, I would first say don't be afraid of them. Even if you're not a numbers person, a lot of people say, well, I really don't understand numbers, or I really don't, that really doesn't do that. It doesn't click with me. You're really just looking for clues, trends, uncovering what doesn't look right. The in-depth knowledge of finances, you don't even have to have that. Look at your bank account, right? See what looks normal to you. And we pay rent, we pay utilities, we pay our mortgage, we pay our car payment, we make our insurance payments. We'll see what's kind of look at what your investigation, look at those financial records in your investigation. What looks normal, right? Identify what doesn't look normal. If you're whatever business you're in, and it's something that you're buying or purchasing or sending money to that is completely unassociated with the widget that you're selling or creating or manufacturing, that's why. I think ask the questions why. Always remain unbiased during any investigation. There might be that accusation, but like I said earlier in my past work, are you trying to prove them guilty? Or are you trying to prove them innocent? You're just trying to prove, was a crime committed? It's up to the courts to find them guilty or innocent, right? Mm-hmm. It's our job to say, yeah, this doesn't look right, and then dig into it and say, okay, this is why, yep, this is why. And it's usually that onion layer effect, right? When mm-hmm. we find one thing and we peel that layer back, and then we get something else and we peel that next layer back, you can't get to the center of that onion until you peel all of those layers back. And that's really how your story reveals itself. I would say definitely stay the course, even with another dead end, back up and punt. one of the best pieces of advice that one of my supervisors when I was an investigator told me, when I would get wrapped around the axle and I'm just like, I just don't know. I just don't know if this is the right way. And he would always tell me, he said, Amanda, throw it against the wall and see what sticks. And a lot of times you really just have to do that, because you may be going down this rabbit hole that it's not going to be fruitful for you if there's nothing there. But it was my bias that kept me going down that rabbit hole. Well, there's nothing that's really not, my case is not going to stand on this one rabbit hole. It's going to be all of the other quote unquote layers of that onion that are going to help build my case. So stay the course and remain unbiased. Sometimes you have to back up and eliminate yourself sometimes, and then go back to it, throw it against the wall, see what sticks, and put fresh eyes on it in the morning.
Very good. All right. And you did mention that you're an Excel nerd. I know it might be difficult on audio, on a podcast, to give a tip in Excel. Do you have a tip or a favorite tip that you like to talk about?
I should have all of them. I love mm-hmm. a little bit of an everything, even just small little mouse clicks that can help you fill a column or whatever. I mean, that's something as simple as that, and something as complex as a nested if and then statement. I love that. I love a nested if and then statement. And I know people are probably going to be like, I don't know who this woman is, but she needs a hobby. Okay. But it's something that's very rewarding when that formula works. So
yeah. No, it's funny, because I was just dealing with some ifs this morning at work, and it gets to the point where there's so many arguments there that I start to get confused myself, right? So I was literally doing the, if you hit the shift F3, it takes you to like the arguments window for the function, and it'll break each segment down for you and ask you, okay, this is what we're looking for here. And it gives a little bit better description as opposed to just typing it out from beginning to end or clicking. But yeah, when you get some of those either some ifs or an if statement that gets multi-layered, it can get really confusing really quickly.
Yes. And when you're dealing with that, such a long formula, I think one of my things, and I actually helped, this actually helped some folks in the academy when we were going through some of the Excel stuff, is I don't necessarily write my formulas horizontal, but I write them vertically. And in Excel, when you're in that formula bar, everything is typing left or right. But if you're starting your if and then, or your if and, or your if and or whatever it is, you have your if and then your or, and then you have whatever is in your first parenthesis, your first set of parentheses, and then you have a comma, go down to the next line and do your next set of parentheses. So that way, because as well as I do, the error in your formula can come down to a comma or a parenthesis. And that, looking at it on the on that horizontal formula line, sometimes is just, it's grueling, and it will make you start seeing double. But I see if I write it on a formula, like on a Word document, if I just go and line by line on all of my arguments that I'm making, I can see that I have answered every question in that formula, and then be able to close my parentheses, copy and paste into my formula, and see what works.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that. Because I do that when I'm writing SQL. When I'm writing a case statement for SQL, I like to have it on multiple lines, like if then else. I like to have them all on separate lines, and then I can see what's going where and what's the logic.
Yes, absolutely. Very, very similar to that, the way that that looks. And it just helps you keep track of that easier to make sure that you haven't missed a comma or you haven't missed a parenthesis.
Very good. All right. Well, let's finish up with some personal interest then. You're a thrifter. Is that what you would describe yourself as a thrifter?
I do. I love to go to a Goodwill, go to thrift shops, repurposing things. I'm always looking for a good deal. It's just, I don't know, it's just in me. It's just like a good sale, going and finding a good sale or having a 50% off coupon. I mean, when you walk into Goodwill or you walk into a thrift store, everything's already 50% off what you would normally pay in the store. So, and then when you walk in thrift store, it may be that pink tags are an additional 50% off or whatever. So, I really enjoy that. It's mindless shopping, just being able to do that. I generally do that with my best friend of 46 years. She's a thrifting lover as well. So we took one Saturday here a couple of months back, and we went up Tallahassee, went up into Georgia, headed over to Marianna, and came back down through the panhandle, and just did this big, huge loop of did nothing but going to thrift stores all day long. So, and it's great because it, the road trip and a thrifting trip all in one. So.
Oh, man. Do you have a favorite item that you got in the thrift store, or like something that you really thought was a good buy?
I'm a sucker for graphic signs. I love a good sign with a good saying on it. But I think my second thing too is finding an outfit or finding a piece of clothing, and then it still has the tags on it. You know, because a lot of people say, oh, this is used. Well, there's a lot of stuff that's brand new in a thrift shop that nobody's worn it. It's still got the tags from, I found some. I find Calvin Klein, I found Tommy Hilfiger, I find Hollister. There's like Skechers, and I mean, there's a lot of name brands in thrift stores and in Goodwills that you would be shocked. But I don't know, that's a good deal if you can go in and get brand name stuff for 50% off.
Yeah, no, you definitely get unique stuff, right? It's definitely one of a kind type stuff. And it's funny you mentioned the signs. On my covered back deck, I'm in the process of just putting up signs. The snarkier, the better. The sillier and funnier, the better. And so every once in a while, I'll go out and if I, especially at a garage sale or something like that, if I find a sign, I like to bring it back home and put it in my back deck.
Yes, so. Absolutely. I would encourage you to go to Goodwill, go to the thrift store. Yes, yard sales. Yard sales is a good thing too. I actually do yard sales with my husband. We'll wake up on a Saturday, grab a cup of coffee, and just set out and look for garage sale signs. No plan in hand. Just mindfully going for a Jeep ride, if you will, because he is a Jeeper. So going on a Jeep ride and looking for a yard sale.
Well, the Jeep also helps you keep the amount that you buy pretty low. So there's only so much room in that Jeep, right? So you don't go too crazy.
Yes, exactly. And what's funny is because I drive a larger SUV, so I think you just may have just put me onto his strategic game. Let's take the Jeep, because the less room that we have, the less stuff that I can buy.
You're like, oh, sorry, hon, we don't have room for that.
Exactly.
All right, very good, Amanda. Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. This is where you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
I think something that a key thing for me in my journey, because I don't know that I really touched on it, but yeah, I did graduate with my bachelor's in 2018. That was almost like a lifelong journey for me because I was the non-traditional student. I was married, had a family, working full-time. My son was in year-round sports, had volunteering that I was doing, all the while becoming a college graduate and all of that. So in 2018, I graduated with my bachelor's, and I had taken a leadership class at my church from a former pastor. And one of the sayings that really was pivotal in that leadership class was this, and it's, discipline is simply doing what you don't want to do to be able to do what you want to do. And I think that if I could encourage anyone that's out there that is the non-traditional student, or I mean, heck, you may even be an analyst out there that you're in a position where it's not exactly where you want to be. Just remember that discipline is simply doing what you don't want to do to be able to do what you want to do. In those nights after I put my son to bed, it was then my time to do my homework. And then I had an assignment that was due before midnight. In those moments, I didn't want to do that, but it was the discipline that I had to do it to put me on that graduation stage in 2018. And I would say, as an analyst, if you're in a position where you're not where you want to be in the industry or in your agency or in life, find the discipline, dig deep and remember your why, and just simply do what you don't want to do right now to be able to do what you want to do in the future.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with you giving me just enough to talk bad about you later.
As my daddy would say, if you're talking about me, you're giving somebody else a break.
Well, I do appreciate you being on the show, Amanda. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you. You as well, Jason.
Thank you for making it to the end of another episode of Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. You can show your support by sharing this and other episodes found on our website at www.leapodcasts.com. If you have a topic you would like us to cover or have a suggestion for our next guest, please send us an email at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Till next time, analysts, keep talking.